Hello everyone, my name's Courtney and I'm an addict. I've been dreading that microphone, but anyway, there it is. So I just want to thank Charlie for asking me to do the chair tonight. And it was quite funny, on the day I got a text from him just before I had one of those days, and I don't get these days that often anymore. But I just thought, if anybody tells me to work a step around it, if anybody recommends a psychotherapist, if I see one more self-help book, I just felt like I had so many ideas about various therapeutic models that I just had enough. It's like one of those days. And a text came through, and I thought, I don't want to go to a meeting. And the text came through, and it's like, will you do the Trafalgar Square meeting? And I said, yes, because one of the first things my first sponsor told me was that if you get asked to do a chair, you always say yes. So right from the beginning, even though I was terrified to do chairs, I've always done them. So that kind of shows you, in spite of my thinking, which can, you know, fall in and love, you know, in and out of love with NA, I still kind of, you know, step up when I'm asked to do service. And I still override that. And just to give you some sort of a brief history of my recovery, really. And the beautiful Lee is here, and she took me to my second meeting when I was 27. And I first went to NA when I was 19, and like I should imagine any 19-year-old, I went in and I saw these terribly old people. They were probably all about 29, 30, and I thought they were ancient. And, you know, and speaking this strange medieval language, and I was sort of cranking up to third gear by then. I was just, you know, it was still quite glamorous, backstage parties, clubs, you know, hanging out with people who were into fashion and art. So, you know, there wasn't really anything. I hadn't had a particular rock bottom, but I often think, like, what would have happened, you know, where would I be now if I'd cleaned up? Anyway, I didn't, and I came back many years later when I was 27, and I was so immersed in kind of street drug culture, you know, that when I remember going to a meeting and I was actually listening, by then I'd completely changed, and I was like, I was really paranoid. I was self-obsessed to the point of paranoia. I was like, why are all these healthy, well-dressed people saying that they're addicts? And I was like a rabbit in the headlights. And I was so entrenched in the whole drug culture that I could not understand a concept of recovery. Recovery was Sunday. You know, I wake up on Sunday and had a kind of day off, which meant I usually took methadone and, you know, drank later than normal, whatever. So, you know, and I was thinking recently that over the years my ideas of what recovery is has changed. And when I first came around, which eventually I had to go to rehab when I was 39, and basically a friend of mine had overdosed, and I'd supplied him with the heroin that he overdosed on, and we'd known each other. He was my sort of first serious boyfriend when I was 19. We were very much into that whole kind of rock and roll thing, but we enabled each other's addiction. And when I came in, there was one mutual friend of ours who'd cleaned up years before, and he said, you know what, I always knew that one of you would have to die before the other got recovery. And I was quite horrified at that at the beginning. I kind of thought, you know, it's quite a kind of dark thing to say. But I actually see where he's coming from, because we had a really unhealthy friendship. So he died, and I ended up, I kind of, you know, it was basically the party was over. He was one of my oldest, even though we had an unhealthy relationship, one of my oldest, dearest friends. So I ended up in rehab, and I was kind of willing to as much as I could be at that time. And I was just thinking the other day how my notions of recovery have dramatically changed. And I think when I first cleaned up and I'd gone through the various stages that you do, you know, bleaching the house and, you know, putting clean sheets on the bed and had some kind of notion of being clean, I kind of thought I'd get to a comfort zone. I'd arrive at this place, sooner or later, I'd arrive at this place, and it'd be really comfortable, and I'd just kind of, you know, get settled down, and that's where I'd stay, like some kind of Buddha or something. And actually what I found was my early recovery was really challenging. I didn't have a pink cloud. I had an issue with, you know, just as I cleaned up, there was prostitutes and drug dealers upstairs, and it was, you know, the irony of that. And I couldn't sleep, and because of my lack of sleep, I actually got suicidal thoughts. And I do remember that time thinking, well, you know, you know, I don't want to use, because I knew there was nothing there. You know, I'd nearly 30 years of using. So what could I do? And I remember getting this thought going, well, you could commit suicide. And I remember that, you know, suicidal thoughts, how they presented themselves to me was like a solution. It was a very quiet voice. It wasn't traumatic. It wasn't like, you know, running in front of a train and, you know, you show the world. You know, it wasn't anything like you see in the films. It was a very quiet voice. So, you know, my early recovery was really challenging. And I never got to that comfort zone, and it was really difficult. But I kept staying clean. I kept going to meetings and I kept staying clean. And since that time, I've kind of thought about recovery in different ways. Then I went through a phase where I remember when I came round that everybody was saying things like, you know, stay around and your wildest dreams will come true. And that's a dangerous thing to say to a delusional narcissist like me, because, you know, I went straight into, oh, that's what recovery is. And I thought, yeah, I become one half of a power couple. And, you know, we're celebrated and we walk into the room. So I got a boyfriend and he was a builder. And that didn't quite fit in with my power couple fantasy. So I pushed him towards studying architecture at uni. Poor sod. I don't know if he wanted to study architecture at uni, but, you know, off he went. And then, you know, that's my defect of grandiosity coming out. And I was going to become this mega artist and we were going to be selling and we were going to be applauded by you all and burst into zillion stars. And that was my other recovery. And I spoke to a friend the other day, and she cracked me up because she said she hooked up with a guy and she seriously thought they were the Posh and Becks of NA. And apparently he even asked for a hand in marriage at the Brixton meeting, and hence to say it didn't last long. So, you know, we all come in, and, you know, and I did all the other stuff. I lost weight, you know, I took pride in my appearance. I did all the stuff that I thought was recovery. And since that time, I keep changing my mind. I also went back and worked as a teacher. So I remember being in rehab and saying, you know, how do you feel about yourself? And I wrote on the whiteboard that I feel mostly ineffectual, because no matter how hard I tried, no matter how many to-do lists and how many projects or how many wild schemes I came up with, they all turned, you know, they none of them manifested, because I just was too inconsistent. My using just kind of sabotaged everything, relationships, careers, you know, everything in my life. So I actually went back to study to be a teacher, and I worked, you know, unbelievably for 8 years. I've just given up teaching. And the social, you know, that was social acceptability. And I do remember being 4 years clean and standing in front of a group of teenagers, and teenagers are like heat-seeking missiles. You know, they look for your vulnerability, and I was absolutely terrified. And I remember some kid who had behavioural issues, and I forgot to put him in the register, and he came back and noticed, and he was shouting at me, "You're not a proper teacher, and you're not a..." And I remember being really terrified. How do I deal with this? And I'm, you know, and I still had that thing playing out. They're gonna know I'm a junkie. They can smell the fear. And I remember this kid shouting at me, and I remember doing this weird, my version of a teacher, which was kind of a bit of Judge Judy and a bit of Prime of Miss Jean Brody, and it was a real weird hybrid mix of what I thought a normal person should be. And basically he shouted in my face. I remember phoning my sponsor from the toilet and saying, "I'm in the cubicle of shame." And she said, what are you doing in the cubicle of shame? I said, "I've just had this kid kind of shout at me and I'm so embarrassed." And basically what I realised is, you know, my fear was bigger. My fear of these teenagers were going to do something terrible was bigger than what happened. And once this kid shouted at me, I said, you know what, that's probably the worst that's going to happen. These kids are going to have a pop at me. And it was kind of weird. And then I realised, you know, the self-centred fear of the addict is always bigger than the actual thing. And, you know, having said that, I still have to push past that, you know, on a daily basis. And, you know, and I went through, and I recently had to give up the job because lots of redundancies. I lost hours, I lost money, and it got to the point where I was literally just kind of working to pay the rent, and got put in another redundancy pool, so I've left. So I find myself in this really weird position that I'm 12 years clean and yet I'm unemployed and I'm back on benefits. And the other day I did find myself watching Jerry Springer and overeating, and I thought, I'm going to be one of those people that they, thank you, that they sort of, you know, have to, you know, hoist me out in a year's time and to have a gastric band or whatever. That was my other bizarre fantasy. But I think what I've learned about recovery over the years is, you know, doing the steps. When I did the steps in rehab, I did them because I kind of had to. And I did them like homework. You know, when the teacher tells you to do homework, and you do it kind of begrudgingly, and you kind of, you know, and I was a good student. I was a good student, but I was a naughty student. So I kind of knew what to do and knew what to say, and I went through the kind of process. And then when I came out and I got sponsors, I did it again, and I did it academically. And I have to keep repeating the steps. And I remember doing step one, and step one's like looking at the evidence. You know, it's looking at, for me, years and years of evidence. I mean, you can't argue with step one, and yet we do, you know. And it's like, so even though it was all there, like years and years of, you know, I mean, it's easy for me to tell you, you know, what drugs I didn't take. My mum phoned up the other day and said, did you try that meow meow? And I was like, no, mum, that was before my, you know, that's after my time. I think she just liked the idea of this drug called meow meow. So I tried every drug that there was, and I didn't have a drug of choice. And even though I did that step one a number of times, I remember with my first sponsor, I was still negotiating. The disease was still trying to find a way out. And so each step I've done, they've gone from purely academic to, as I've repeated them, and with time, and with an, you know, as I've moved into my recovery from being very resistant, very cynical, I've interpreted them in a way that's very meaningful to me. And then it's an emotion, and then it resonates with me, and I feel that it's something, it's very different from the academic, early, superficial doing the steps. And one of the most harrowing step ones I had to do a couple of years ago is my best friend died of alcoholism. You know, and this woman, on her, you know, if you looked at her CV, she was like, you know, talented, private school, husband was a partner in Linklaters, you know, had it all going on. And yet, towards the end, I had to help her walk to the toilet. She was covered in psoriasis. I remember going into the hospital one day and I saw that she looked right through me, and I knew her brain had shut down. And I was able, because of this program, to sit by the hospital bed and play her Barry Manilow. She didn't really like Barry Manilow. It was an ironic, crazy thing. But I was able to be there and hold her hand, even though it was a harrowing, scary thing for me to, because of this program. And what I found out, I'm about to do another step four, and I've sat on that for a year, like you do. And my first step four revealed to me, I didn't really understand my first step four because it was a really, again, quite academic. But what it made me realise is I always thought I was this sort of bohemian, open-minded, free spirit. And when I looked at step four, I was like a character out of EastEnders. It was like, oh, you know, where's this kind of free-spirited open mind? And it was like, she said, and he said, and he said this, and she's, and I realised that addiction had made my life just shrink into this tiny, mealy-mouthed, you know that, you know, you get stuck in all the kind of just the kind of bullshit of addiction, you know, the who owes you 20 mils, he owes me a five, oh, you know, all that sort of stuff. And that was a huge disappointment. And this step four, I think, is going to reveal to me, at 12 years clean, more self-defeating behaviours, because I still, you know, as I go through, I mean, the fact that I became employable is a miracle. And now I've moved away from that because I want to be self-employed, and I want to see, can my wildest dreams of being an artist and being paid for it come true? Am I running out of time? Okay, a few more minutes. So I'm really scared about that. So like I said, I ended up watching Jerry Springer, so I'm quite frightened about, can I do this? And I thought, you know what, I did a chair, funny enough, last night, and I was talking about, you know, that I got told my dreams could come true. And there's still part of me I've realised I don't believe that. And this guy shared back to me, and he said, well, you know, it means our wildest dreams will come true. It means beyond the limits of our imagination. And as addicts, you know, our imagination was kind of wild on one level, but very limited, because I didn't really imagine that I could get clean. Didn't really imagine that I could be employed. I didn't really imagine that I could do all the things I've done. So he kind of really explained it to me. It's pushing past that self-centred fear. So it's made me realise, although social acceptability in the job I did of service, and I saw my students today and they send me messages on Facebook that say you're a legend, and it really makes me, God, you know, it really makes me proud. I've realised social acceptability also doesn't equal recovery, and I'm about to go into this other part of my journey, which is different, but it's really quite spiritual, and it's about my dreams, not my parents' dreams, not anybody else's dreams, but my dreams. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.